Welcome to the latest edition of the Sea Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. I am, as always, your semi-helpful host and director of online content at SimSec, Matthew Hipple. With the P5 plus one Iran nuclear deal on the table last week, we turn our eyes to Iran and her varied global and regional machinations. Is Iran ascendant, overstretched, or is it a wash? Friend of the podcast, Behnam Ben Talablu, joins us again to discuss the Iran nuclear deal, as well as Iranian regional military and political operations. So sit back, relax, and we'll be back with Behnam on Iran right after this short message from my wife.
Do you like the Sea Control podcast? Sure, we all do. However, we're only a small sea in the ocean of content available to you, our dear listener, at the SimSec website. Sign up for a membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. China may have a 9-dash line, but our seas are clear, and we welcome your opinions and articles. Please take a moment while downloading this podcast to leave us a 5-star rating and a comment. We need them. Seriously, how do you think we pay this electric bill? Money?
And welcome to another edition of the Sea Control Podcast. As some of you may have seen last week, there is now a framework for an Iran nuclear deal on the table. At the same time, you have the fall of the government in Yemen. You have Iranian units operating in Iraq. So the question is Iran ascendant in the Middle East? And here to talk about that today is Behnam Ben Talablu, friend of the podcast. And Ben, rather than read a little biography here for you, I'll let you introduce yourself.
Thanks a lot, Matt. Great to be here again. As you said, yeah, I'm a friend of the podcast. Currently, I'm an Iran research analyst at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies here in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital. Before that, I was working mostly on nuclear issues, and even before that, worked and interned in a host of think tanks and communication and consulting firms on strategic issues related to Iran. So yeah, great to be here. Obviously, my views are not necessarily my employer's, so everything here is my personal opinion, but great to be back.
Absolutely. This podcast is essentially a black box that represents no one's employers and anything like that. So let's start out with the nuclear deal is rather fresh, actually, today when we record. And before we started the podcast, a good way to describe what this deal entails and some of the controversy already coming out about it, you can describe, in particular, you mentioned a language difference between what the English version of this deal says and what the Iranian version of the deal is saying.
That's correct, Matt. So the deal that has been put out, or the framework agreement, rather, is for what the administration in the P5 plus one calls this thing called the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. So they really just added a C to the Joint Plan of Action, which was the Geneva deal in November 2013. This JCPOA is supposed to be the broad final accord. So the parameters that came out today in what is a 5-page or 4-page document released on the State Department's website are categorized by topic on based on what Iran has to do. So whereas the other deal was Iran, U.S., moving forward, these are by topic. So there's sections on enrichment, reactors, what have you. Whereas the way the Iranian press presented this deal was with a bit more pomp and circumstance, a bit more narrative. In fact, when I was listening to CNN, their dubbing in English was a little bit slow. Zarif answered questions of Persian reporters. Some Persian reporters dubbed this a great victory, or just a victory, or great achievement, rather. And so one of the ways that they differ is that content-wise, they share the base or the price floor of what must be done. The English version is a lot more detailed as to the nature of Iranian concessions. The Iranian version, however, pushes home the narrative of victory without actually saying it. So whereas the heading for the enrichment category in the English one is simply enrichment, the Iranian one is continuation of the nuclear program, including enrichment. So they're presupposed on what Iran was doing before the agreement was right, and that the powers have come around to recognizing and legitimizing it. It's a very different narrative.
So maybe you could describe what are some of the concessions the P5 plus one have stated that they have come away with that brought them to the table on this deal. And is it in particular these titles that are the contention with the Iranians, or is the Iranian version of the document explicitly missing details and numbers and those aspects of the deal that the P5 plus one have walked away with a positive feeling about?
Well, one of those aspects that there's a clear difference is the final portion of the document, which is the phasing. So as of 2011, in the P5 plus one and Iran negotiations, the phasing was assumed to be the logic of how sanctions removal and Iranian nuclear concessions was supposed to be one-to-one. That was something that was mentioned in 2011 and just kind of on the back burner and assumed since then throughout all the negotiations. The phasing one on the Western side, or the English language document, works off of this thing that we call the sunset clause. So it mentions the 10 years of limitations on Iranian domestic enrichment. All of these different factors on limiting Iran's domestic enrichment, be they centrifuges, the stockpile of enriched uranium Iran gets to keep, the type of centrifuges, the number of centrifuges, are all designed to give the international community a one-year breakout time. But beyond that, there's things that go past the 10-year sunset clause, which are, there's one for 15 years, where parts of the Iranian nuclear program, such as the Fordo facility, the underground uranium enrichment center that's under a mountain near the holy city of Qom, they are not supposed to enrich uranium there for 15 years. So there's these little things like that. Whereas the Iranian side, the only number that you really see appears to be 10. The references are to the 10-year duration of the sunset clause, where there are some references here, as far as my eye could see, that include 15 and 25 years. Now, the Iranians have obviously accepted this, but their desire to present this in this fashion to their own public is telling.
So, at the beginning of the podcast, I may have been a little bit dour in use of the term ascendant, and I think something that you've said does touch on whether or not this is the case in the particular issue of the nuclear deal. When you say that the Iranians propose this deal to their population in a certain way, is that because they believe that narrative and so have no reason to hide it, or is it possibly, to those that are more optimistic, this a way of them walking away and saying, we are victorious, but still accepting the deal that the West is looking for, so they can have their cake and eat it too?
That's an interesting dichotomy you picked up. One thing I would immediately say off the bat is that it's not about proposing it to their population as much as it is presenting it to their population. And I don't want to spice words too much here, but one of the things that the Iranians have going for them is that while Iran has like very dynamic domestic politics, they're not democratic domestic politics. They're, you know, they can be populist, Islamist, nationalist, but they're not of a democratic nature. So it's not like, you know, they'll do a straw poll vote and then go on and see, you know, 51% of the population likes this or not. The Iranian people writ large actually, I think, would back any deal because they want the sanctions lifted. And, you know, civil society, I think, has been pushing nuclear diplomacy for a long time now inside Iran. But unfortunately, they don't have their finger on the nuclear trigger, so to speak, and the government is not indicative of those wishes of the population. Iran presents the deal to their population more as opposed to proposing it. Whereas on the U.S. side, I think there are some significant concessions based on the previous rhetoric of the Obama administration and the previous desire of the United States across two administrations, the Bush administration and the Obama administration, on how to exactly curb, deny, roll back, and limit Iran's nuclear program. On that Western side, I definitely think that if I had to use a document to guide myself, on the technical components of the deal, it would definitely be the English language document, which is called Parameters for a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action Regarding the Islamic Republic of Iran's Nuclear Program. Whereas if I wanted to be cognizant of how the opposing side would see it, I would definitely use the Persian language sources, because they're the ones who have to implement it after all. And if they don't think something is bound on them, you know, we'll see what happens in the next few months by the June 30th deadline. But this is more of a framework and a guideline.
Extending from this nuclear issue, of course, this one instance where some will say it is and some will say it isn't a step towards peace, Iran's, I guess, engagement, in quotes, and general conflict within the region is expanding. Yemen and Iraq, both places where Iran seems to be extending its influence. There's the collapse of the government in Yemen. There's the Iranian military's engagement in Iraq. Benham, before the podcast, you mentioned that there was sort of a triumvirate, or a triad, as it were, of aspects of what you saw as Iranian movement towards ascendancy. And taking all of these issues together, I thought maybe you could put forward that idea and we could discuss it a little bit.
Absolutely, and I think you hit the nail right on the head there, which is there's a grand irony in all of this. The Rouhani administration has made lots of strides in Iran to unite the warring domestic factions, but also the create consensus within the leadership that a nuclear deal is in Iran's at least short-term interests. But many who had put their bets on Rouhani in the international community and the West, and even more that within the United States, saw him as a general moderating figure. Whereas it seems that Rouhani, in fact, has been willing to neglect the regional portfolio writ large. So as you correctly stated, the regional situation has been worsening. And this has undercut a guiding assumption of U.S. foreign policy towards the Middle East and towards Iran for at least two administrations now, which is that some sort of diplomacy with Iran over its nuclear program, so ironing out the technical threats that Iran poses by its nuclear infrastructure, would have peace dividends in the Middle East. Whereas we are, in fact, beginning to see the opposite. The closer Iran gets to this deal, the more so U.S. allies appear agitated. And this, of course, has a very nice Cold War parallel, whereas the Soviet Union may have believed, and, you know, the doctrine of MAD notwithstanding, may have believed U.S. nuclear threats, specifically during the Eisenhower administration. The French and the British for their own national reasons, but the French, as an independent European force, didn't believe in extended deterrence from the United States. Whereas the Soviets, who are enemies, did, our allies didn't. So our allies in the Middle East, specifically the Arab states of the Persian Gulf and Israel, are beginning to doubt U.S. intentions and credibility and capability in the Middle East as a nuclear deal is moving closer. So it's the same Cold War parallel playing out, but in a much more tense region. So that's the broader narrative I want to paint. And then that theater, Yemen, which you put your hands on, very interesting, but also a little trio, Iraq, Bahrain, Syria, many of the other states that have experienced Arab Spring upheavals. Iran has been somewhat successful in most theaters at co-opting local forces or paying local forces, such as the Houthis. They call themselves Ansar Allah, the supporters of God, in Arabic that translates to, in Yemen. So while they're not, some may not be direct agents or proxies of Iran, like the Houthis, because they have a movement that has been spanning for decades in Yemen. They're part of Yemen's political and military history. They're not, you know, like the Hezbollah, though Iran is increasingly forming it or using money and arms shipments to create a Hezbollah-type force. In fact, an Iranian former foreign minister in 2014 likened the outcome of the Houthis to Hezbollah. So Iran is using money and arms shipments to a host of different proxies, allies, states, and forces in the Middle East to push forward its regional agenda. And this is coming at a time when it's doing its nuclear diplomacy. So the irony is that Iran is expanding its regional capabilities and expanding and supporting its regional allies at a time that the Middle East is turning against them. And we can hit on in another question, Iraq more specifically, Yemen more specifically, and Syria more specifically. But this triumvirate of a consensus in Tehran, nuclear diplomacy ongoing and in Iran's favor, and regional matters turning towards Iran, this trio is a little bit of a dangerous mix that we need to be cognizant of.
Now, would you, as a way of leading into Iraq or Yemen, do you think in either one of these theaters that Iranian influence or the Iranian military or whatever tools that they're using, and we'll discuss those in particular based on each theater, are they extending themselves too far? And would you say that either one of these serves as sort of that case where maybe the Iranians have gotten a larger eyes than they have stomach?
If I had to ascribe that to a theater, I think it would have to be Syria. Syria really is existential for the Islamic Republic of Iran. There's a physical land bridge between Syria and Lebanon, and Lebanon is the most successful case that, you know, this has been proven time and again, but mostly underscored by the 2006 Hezbollah-Israel war, that Hezbollah is the most successful version of exporting the Iranian revolution abroad. Creating that militia force, that proxy force, giving it political power, giving it military power. They basically hold a veto vote in the Lebanese government at present, and they have not disarmed. And they are, you know, used by Iran for foreign operations abroad, you know, be it in Argentina, be it in Bulgaria. You know, Hezbollah has had an effect and has served Iran's interests abroad. So Syria, the government that the Assad regime in Syria, keeping that regime there or keeping a government that is allied towards Tehran and will continue to provide support to Hezbollah is key for Tehran. So that's why I think the Syrian theater is probably the most important one. Iran has lost a lot of its operatives in Syria, specifically high-level Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps members, Quds Force members. There was a small little piece I wrote in the Long War Journal about Iranian reactions to the killing of this man. I believe it was Brigadier General Al-Adadi. And he was killed by those Israeli helicopter gunships near the Golan Heights in 2015. And the loss of such a person, but also such a high-level person for Iran, underscores the investments they've made. There's a human investment at that level. Training investment. There was a great BBC documentary about IRGC forces running around in Syria. And even political capital. You know, Iran has gone from being ascendant in the hearts and minds of the Muslim Middle East and the Arab world, because it used to poke a finger in the eye and was constantly a thorn in Israel's side. But now it has aggravated its Arab neighbors, and the war in Syria has bled it of the goodwill that it used to have, or at least allegedly used to have. So Syria is really a different theater. Iran is overstretched, in my opinion, there. In fact, there's a great report on Iran and Syria by this group called Naam Isham, and they actually use the word occupying. They use legal pretenses to show that Iran is, in fact, an occupying force in Syria. So it's gone way beyond that, and yes, it is overextended in that theater.
So you said that Syria is an overextension, but you've also said that Syria is somewhat an existential fight because of the gains that the Iranians have made in capability, both diplomatically and militarily, through the use of their agents in Syria and Lebanon. What then would your commentary be on their operations within Iraq? Is this ultimately also a battle of survival against the possible incursion of ISIS, or is this an attempt to create a bridge to Syria? Or what do you think is the nature? Is this just to turn Iraq into a client state? What are Iran's goals, would you say, in Iraq, and how far do you think they're willing to go in their commitment to Iraq?
That's a very interesting way to put it, because there hasn't been a clear upfront proposition for Iraq within, at least that I could discern, within the Iranian leadership, within the strategic brain trust, if you will. As there has been for Syria, whereas many have come out saying, we must save Syria. With Iraq, it's been very interesting because you had the transition from the Maliki government last year, late last summer, I believe it was. You've had the rise of this force, the Islamic State, self-proclaimed Islamic State, which has many fighting against it. You know, it's inflamed the region against it. It engages in these disgusting acts, immolations, rapes, these brutal acts that have really turned the region against it, rightly so. So Iran is combating the Islamic State there. But what it's also doing by supporting sectarian Shiite militias is it's further poisoning the wells of the Iraqi people. So the Iraqi people should not have to choose between an Iranian proxy on a sectarian rampage, such as Asayb al-Haq, the League of the Righteous, or they should not have to choose between the self-proclaimed Islamic State, who engages, in their own atrocities. You saw what happened to that Jordanian pilot. That's not a choice the Iraqi people should be forced to pick between. So Iran's goals in Syria, while it is to push back and rid the Iraq of the Islamic State, it's to make sure the central government in Baghdad remains Shiite, remains allied towards Iran, remains confident in its conviction that Tehran is a stronger ally than Washington. That's a conviction they want the Iraqi state to have. So once Iraqi oil comes back online in full, once ISIS is gone, they know that Iraq will retain the significant incentive to turn towards Washington, to get aid from Washington. Its technology is better, its money, it's a lot more U.S. money than Iranian money that could go to supporting, stabilizing Iraq. U.S. capabilities far outweigh Iranian capabilities, but at the same time, Iran wants to show that it is going to be in the region forever, and the U.S. is fleeting. It's a fleeting power, and it's a poor ally. There's a line I like to cite that was cited in a great New Yorker piece in 2013, and it's a line quoting Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, Quds Force. And he said this in relation to Syria, but I think it applies to any Iranian ally. He said, "We're not like the Americans. We don't abandon our friends." And that's a powerful statement. That's a very powerful statement. And that's a statement Iran uses to sell itself and sell its proxies to the Iraqis. And when it doesn't need to sell it, it can do it through sheer force. So you saw what happened in Tikrit. You saw what happened in previous cities that Iran had liberated by way of these Shiite militias that operate alongside the Iraqi military. So in Amrli, in Jurfosakhr, and then Tikrit later on, these militias were instrumental. Tikrit is an interesting case. I don't want to get on a tangent here, but recently there was an interesting Wall Street Journal piece that said that Iran was underperforming, or its Iranian forces, and specifically the Shiite militias, were underperforming in Iraq. And that's one of the reasons that the U.S. was able to step in the way it did. We saw some Shiite militias stepped away when the U.S. increased its support to the fight to liberate Tikrit. I think that's something the United States should stand up for and do and help rid the country of ISIS so that Iran does not have that argument that we are a better ally than the United States. So their main goal there would be to keep the central government in Baghdad in power, make sure that they're Shiite, and also convince them of this argument. And we need to push back against that. I apologize if that was really long.
No, not at all. So I'm glad that you led into that issue of Iran pushing forward this idea of it being the most reliable ally in the region, because now we see with Operation Decisive Storm, Gulf States, Egypt, just a broad coalition of Middle Eastern countries are taking the stick to Yemen. And my question to you then would be, oh, come on, bro.
Sorry, my phone just busted.
Okay. My question to you would be, is what is Iran's reaction going to be? It doesn't have, I imagine, the easy ability to send support out to Yemen. I'm sure it can fund its agents in a certain way, but Yemen is surrounded by people who are not happy with Iran right now. So what will Iran's reaction to Decisive Storm look like, and what will the future of Yemen look like as part of this Iranian play for regional ascendancy?
I think that's a great question, because each theater you've hit on, Syria, Iraq and now Yemen, there's been a different Iranian strategy because there's a different, A, Iranian assessment of the threat, and B, a different Iranian assessment of what interests are at stake in each theater. And C, Iran uses somewhat different forces. In Syria, for instance, they have the central government. In Iraq, they have the central government. In both those two theaters, because they share a land border, they also have Shiite militias. In Yemen, they don't necessarily have all those advantages. The relationship that Iran has built in the Levant and in Mesopotamia far outweighs, politically, militarily, but also in terms of history, the investments that Iran has put, the Islamic Republic has put into Iraq and Syria over the years, far outweighs the investments it's made into Yemen. That's not to dismiss Iranian support to the Houthis or Iran's newfound interest in poking the eye of Saudi Arabia and the GCC in Yemen. But Iran assesses each theater differently. That's the broader point. And what we need to ask ourselves in the analytical community and in Washington and in academia and in what we need to ask ourselves, the analytical community writ large, is what is the nature of Iranian empire? There's a lot of statements on Iranian empire. You know, Iranian parliamentarians themselves talk about possessing Arab capitals. But what is the nature of that possession? How does the possession look in Iraq? What is the possession like in Yemen? What is the possession like in Bahrain? How does it differ? So in the ways that they're the same, it's arms shipments, money, and political support. In the way that they differ, Yemen comes in because there's not that geographical land bridge that you mentioned, and there's a lot more investment. Yemen is you know, Saudi Arabia has a long history of intervention in Yemen. It's, you know, literally on the Arabian Peninsula. Very different political, military culture, very different culture writ large, despite the Houthis being Shiites. They're Zaydis, they're Fivers, whereas Iran, they're Twelvers, which is the majority kind of Shiite that you have in Iran, Iraq, Bahrain, Lebanon. The Yemeni Shiite community is somewhat more subdivided and on its own. So it doesn't have that political, cultural cachet that it does in places like Iraq. So its methods and modus operandi has to change a little bit. Yes, it ships arms. Yes, it gives money. But to Operation Decisive Storm, Iran will have to take it. A successful version of Operation Decisive Storm, that's including that the GCC-led coalition, which also has, you know, Turkey and Pakistan in there too. I believe it's 10 countries fighting or giving support to that coalition. They're doing so mostly not necessarily to counter Iran throughout the region. They have goals that are specific to Yemen, like putting in the president that had fled, Hadi, allegedly putting him back in. That's one reported desire of this coalition of Operation Decisive Storm. And, you know, hypothetically, if the facts on the ground change, Iran can't stop that. It has to go back and rearm the Houthis. There are domestic issues in Yemen, such as Saleh and his family and their connections to the military. Saleh's burned a lot of bridges, even, you know, with the U.S., but seems to have a little bit of a good base of Houthi support. But those are all competing factors that are much more new for Iran than its long-standing ties to the Levant and Mesopotamia. So if the GCC-led coalition is successful, there will be little Iran can do. But the GCC-led coalition might not have that intention in mind. The GCC-led coalition wants to make the symbolic pushback against Iranian encroachment. And I think if they really wanted to do that, they would have done it differently and with more U.S. support in theaters like Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria. Yemen is not as high as a priority for Iran as Iraq, Syria, Lebanon were. And that coalition leading Decisive Storm needs to be cognizant of that. And Iran's investment in local forces and attempts to co-opt local forces in Yemen, they could either double down or they could stop, realistically. But that's not to say that it's not in their scope of interest. It's just not their primary interest. They don't discern it in the way that they discern the existential interest that they have in places like Syria.
You've partially answered my question, but in regards to Operation Decisive Storm, you said that if the GCC had desired to push back against Iran, it would have done it to a greater extent in Syria, and we all remember Turkey had an opportunity to, and it seemed like they would, but they didn't really They would have done it in Iraq, and they would have supported the Iraqis to a greater extent. But then my question is this the beginning of a new attitude towards the extent of Iranian influence, or is it merely symbolic on the way towards continued Iranian interference in the region?
I'm of the opinion that it's symbolic. I think in terms of military effectiveness and capabilities, there will need to be a post-mortem of what's going on, what's been hit in Yemen by Operation Decisive Storm. And that way we can assess like how successful it's been. But I think we should be cognizant that Iran has not invested that much in Yemen as it has in the other theaters. And logically, if the GCC coalition wanted to do that, they would do that elsewhere. But the problem then becomes, if it's symbolic, who is it supposed to be directed at? And I think actually more than being directed at Iran, these Sunni states involved in the decisive storm in Yemen want the U.S. to pay attention, because the U.S. is actually a force in the Persian Gulf to be reckoned with as well. And it's the U.S. that helps maintain that balance of power in the Persian Gulf. Given that, I think it's a shot across the bow. Yes, we might be running intel for them, but they're saying this is what it looks like. And Sisi too, because Egypt's in the coalition. This is what it looks like when we step up. Don't make us have to step up every time, which I think is a subliminal message.
So you say that, in your opinion, take it off the table! Put it on the carpet!
I'm doing Skype on the phone, that's why.
Oh, well, I guess we're out of luck then. So you say that you see this as more symbolic, a message to Iran, a message to the United States, in what this decisive storm coalition is engaging in. Might it be, and I could suggest an alternative for you to consider, might it be actually a test of their capabilities? Sort of, you say that, well, if they really wanted to do this, they would have done it somewhere else. They would have done it in Syria. They would have done it in Iraq. Then why wouldn't they test it out first? Yemen, you say, Yemen is where Iran has invested the least amount of resources. Could this not be this coalition stretching its capabilities to see how far can I go in other regions to counter Iran?
I think in that case, in terms of its military effectiveness, we need to have another real postmortem on this operation when it's done. But these days, specifically, it's the GCC leading Operation Decisive Storm. They tend to have a generally conservative foreign policy demeanor, so I don't see them taking the battle to Iran, either in those theaters or actually to the Iranian homeland on their own. This may have been, in fact, one of the best ways to check all boxes for the GCC and the GCC-led coalition. So are there sectarian tensions? Check. Do we want to stick it to Iran? Check. Do we want to make sure the United States knows that when we get angry, we can take action? Check. Is this the most cost-effective way? Well, if the operation continues to go on, not necessarily, especially given Saudi Arabia's history of incursions into Yemen. But in terms of other theaters to respond to, this probably would be cheaper for the GCC-led coalition. So it fulfills all those bureaucratic requirements and all those regional requirements, whereas militarily, your logic still holds, Matt. But I just don't see the GCC states processing it that way. If they do, it would certainly be a surprise to me.
That's fair. No, that's absolutely fair. And just for an extension, I think Somalia's offering bases in Sudan is involved. I saw the graphic we put up on SimSec, and I had a little tickler in the back of my head, and I just went back to read it. But even Sudan is applying aircraft to this conflict. And so, you know, it's when you say a broad coalition, it is rather surprising and immediate gathering of forces in reaction to this problem. I suppose that would lead into your statement that to get everyone on board to do something all at once like this, this would be better for symbology than it would be for operational effect in how quickly all these forces were gathered up and applied to the situation.
That's right. Sorry, one quick thing on that. That's right, because They would have to look at the interoperability of all these systems. And you hit Sudan, and I just want to bring up this article that two of my colleagues wrote. One focuses on the Arab states of the Persian Gulf, the other on Africa. Saudi Arabia, and through its Wahhabi dawah, but its political power and its recent desire to showcase that political power, which is a market change from its past, does it on select occasions. Its desire to do that, it seems like it might be trying to borrow a phrase, flip Sudan, because, you know, Iran had long-standing ties to Sudan. Bashir is home in Iran. It's one of the few countries he can actually travel to really easily. So Sudan may be in the next few years, according to their analysis, flipped, or they're at least at a price floor, the recipient of more Saudi patronage to try to turn it away from Iran, from the political orientation that it had, and put it more firmly in the Sunni camp.
So, Ben, before we go, any final thoughts, observations, pieces of context, perspective that you'd like to put forward for our audience?
Yeah, just a few points, actually. For many years now, across administrations, the United States has looked at Iran's technical nuclear quest and its military activities and strategic capabilities in the Persian Gulf area and immediate broader Middle East as somewhat separate, whereas in reality they're both components of Iranian behavior. They're both, you know, Iran's desire to enrich something or to create this nuclear facility or to support a local actor or to ship arms somewhere. All of these things are products driven by Iran's national security calculations. They're all part of a greater strategy. And we've really stovepiped them relatively well, maybe a little too well over the years, a desire to extract and execute and sign and implement a technical nuclear agreement against this backdrop of a broader Middle East conflict. You know, I want to stress this point. One of the underwriting assumptions was across administrations that this, even if it's a technical deal or gets Iran to have some nuclear restrictions, that would be welcomed by the region. And the region has done anything really but welcome it. You know, there's reports about Jordan with renewed nuclear interests. That country, UAE has desalinization. It's a U.S. ally. Different effects across Northeast Asia, you know, the North Korean weapon. There's a definite linkage between the Iranian and North Korean nuclear trajectories and their political history together. South Korea is also a great U.S. ally in Northeast Asia, which has foregone technologies that Iran is continuing to flout. So Iran enriches, and it's a U.S. adversary. South Korea does not enrich, and it's a U.S. ally. There are all these compounding questions from a technical perspective, from a regional security perspective, that drive Iran's behavior and are part and parcel of each other, whereas we've been really good for many years now excising these factors when really they're part of a larger equation. So I think it would be beneficial for the analytical community to note the greater interconnectivity of Iranian behavior, be it nuclear, be it regional, be it diplomatic, and be cognizant of those effects.
Well, Ben, it is, as always, a pleasure to have you on the podcast. It's just sort of think about this. We did not think that all of this was going to be going down when we scheduled this podcast, but there you go. You know,
definitely.
I hope this is fortuitous. I hope our discussion is on topics that will actually lead us to the world being a less crazy place, but I think a lot of people assume it's going to be slightly more crazy.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly. But Ben, as always, it is a pleasure, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Matt. Pleasure to be here.